From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There is a logical contradiction in the Russian position and now its actions in Syria. Russia states an intent to fight ISIL on the one hand and to support Bashar al-Assad and his regime on the other.
That was U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter at a press conference at the Pentagon Wednesday as Russia's Air Force swung into action in Syria at the request of the Syrian government.
It does appear that they were in areas where there probably were not ISIL forces, and that is precisely one of the problems with this whole approach.
His statement followed Russian air attacks against a number of positions held by ISIS and, according to some Western media reports, including a headline story in Thursday's New York Times, at least one group trained by the CIA. The possibility of Russian airstrikes against U.S.-backed militias in Syria prompted Carter to call his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, defense minister of the Russian Federation, to schedule a meeting between the two militaries.
Our goals for this meeting are the following. To facilitate the flow of information between coalition forces and Russian elements that will help us maintain the safety of our personnel in the region, which is critical. To ensure that any additional Russian actions do not interfere with our coalition's efforts to degrade and defeat ISIL. And to clarify that broader U.S. security commitments in the region remain unchanged.
Meanwhile, Carter's political counterpart, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, spoke with the press at the United Nations in New York alongside his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We met with Secretary Kerry for the, I think, third time in a few days. Today we devoted our meeting to the follow-up of what our presidents agreed when they met here on the 28th of September. The first instruction to us was to make sure that the military of the United States, the coalition led by the United States on the one hand, and the military of the Russian Federation, who now engage in some operations in Syria at the request of the Syrian government, get in touch and establish channels of communications to avoid any unintended incidents. And we agreed that the military should get into contact with each other very soon. Number two, we also discussed what the presidents told us about the promoting political process. We all want Syria democratic, united, secular, Syria, which is a home for all ethnic and confessional groups whose rights are guaranteed. But we have some differences as for the details on how to get there. But we agreed on some steps which we will undertake very soon, and our experts would undertake very soon, together with other countries, including the United Nations, on creating the conditions for options to be used, to be applied to promote the political process. And I believe that this meeting, as a follow-up to the discussions between the two presidents, is a very useful occasion to promote constructive and safe approaches to the situation in Syria and around it. We agreed to remain in touch with John. As always, we are available for contacts with each other. Thank you very much.
Well, Sergei has described the meeting that we had, which we would both concur was a constructive meeting. I relayed and reiterated the concerns that I expressed in the course of the UN Security Council meeting, which was led by Russia today. Concerns that we have, obviously, about the nature of the targets, the type of targets, and the need for clarity with respect to them. And it is one thing, obviously, to be targeting ISIL. We're concerned, obviously, if that is not what is happening. So, as Sergei said to you, We agreed on the imperative of as soon as possible, perhaps even as soon as tomorrow, but as soon as possible, having a military-to-military deconfliction discussion, meeting, conference, whichever, whatever can be done as soon as possible, because we agree on the urgency of that deconfliction. Secondly, we did discuss a number of different ways to try to address the conflict itself. And several options were agreed to be further discussed. I need to take those back to Washington, to the President and to our team, and I'm sure Sergei will likewise discuss them with President Putin and his team. And we will follow up on that for certain, because we also agreed that it is imperative to find a solution to this conflict and to avoid escalating it in any way or seeing it intensified by forces beyond anybody's control. And finally, the foreign minister and I agreed that there is, even as we don't have yet a resolution with respect to some critical choices in that political solution, we think we have some very specific steps that may be able to help lead in the right direction. That needs to be properly explored, and so we finally agreed we have a lot of work to do, and we're going to get to doing that work as rapidly as possible, understanding fully how urgent this is in the context of refugees flowing out, the impact on Europe, the impact on the region, and understanding also that we need to see Syria kept whole, unified, secular, democratic. And those are big agreements in that regard, and now we need to work on getting there. So we will stay in very close touch and continue to work on this. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Following accusations by some Western media that Russia had hit civilians in its airstrikes in Syria Wednesday, the country's defense ministry, in a statement Thursday, said that Russia had hit 8 Islamic State targets in Syria and that civilian infrastructure was avoided during the operations. Earlier, Reuters had reported that Russia had targeted opposition rebel groups in Homs province rather than Islamic State forces. The agency cited Syrian opposition chief Khalid Khoja, who put the death toll of the bombardment at 36 civilians. Similar claims were made by the BBC, Fox News, Al Jazeera, and a number of other Western news outlets. But Maria Zakharova, a spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry, denied the charge, saying that those reports alleging civilian casualties were published before a single Russian plane had left the ground. Zakharova said that she was amazed by the scale and speed of what she called info injections into social networks, such as photos of alleged victims that appeared on the web as soon as the Russian operation began. Russia has earned the ire of Washington by blocking a number of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government at the U.N. Security Council. Russia and China have thus far both vetoed a total of 4 resolutions that would have enabled a Libya-style scenario of regime change. As a consequence, Washington has begun a campaign to try to strip them of their veto powers in cases where claims of human rights violations or war crimes are raised. The most recent part of that effort is a declaration signed on to by less than 40% of the UN membership and led by France and Mexico. Meanwhile, the high-level debate at the 70th session of the General Assembly continued Wednesday, with the heads of state and other senior officials from around the world presenting their views on the issues facing the world. Among the speakers Wednesday was the President of the State of Palestine, Mahmoud Abbas, who declared that, after nearly a half century of illegal occupation, a crushing blockade, and broken agreements, wars of aggression, and crimes against humanity directed by Israel against his people, his country was no longer bound by its agreements with Tel Aviv.
The transitional Oslo Agreement and its annexes, and the subsequent agreements signed with Israel, stipulated that the agreements should be implemented within a time frame of 5 years, ending in 1999. Ending with what? With full independence for the state of Palestine and the termination of the Israeli occupation. But Israel stopped the completion of the process of withdrawing its forces from areas classified as B and C, which represent, repeat, these two areas represent more than 60% of the territory of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Instead, Israel intensified its settlement activities everywhere and breached all agreements. I repeat, breached all signed accords. Let me recall here the speech made by President Obama in Cairo in 2009, in which he called for the cessation of settlement activities. What was the Israeli response? The Israeli government increased settlement activities by at least 20% in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, thus violating its obligation not to undertake any action illegally and unilaterally that would, and this is also agreed upon, that would prejudge the final solution. Moreover, the occupying power has repeatedly infringed upon the areas classified A, which are supposed to be under full Palestinian security jurisdiction and in which we have developed the institutions of our Palestinian state. Let me repeat, yes, Israel has also violated these areas. All the while, Israel refuses to review the economic agreements that control the ability of the Palestinian economy to develop and become independent. Thus, it is determined to impose dominance on Palestinian economy, similar to its military and security dominance. I repeat, economic, military, and security dominance. Thus, Israel rejecting the right of the Palestinian people to development and to exploit their natural resources. Thus, Israel has destroyed the foundations upon which the political and security agreements are based, which have also been undermined by the measures taken by successive Israeli governments that have negated the transitional phase aimed at realizing the independence of our state and has thus perpetrated gross violations. All this has made the situation unsustainable. Given that background, here, we declare that as long as Israel refuses to commit to the agreements signed with us, which render us a pro forma authority without real powers, and as long as Israel refuses to cease settlement activities and to release of the Palestinian prisoners in accordance with our agreements with Israel, Israel has thus left us no choice but to insist that we will not remain the only ones committed to the implementation of those agreements, while Israel continuously violates them.
At Thursday's session of the General Assembly's debate, the recently re-elected leftist Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, discussed some of the problems facing his country and many others. His talk included a critique of the neoliberal policy of austerity that has caused so much pain and suffering for millions around the world.
Fellow delegates, ladies and gentlemen, 70 years have passed since the UN was founded after the most disastrous war in history. In the wake of this war, the UN's Nobel declarations raised hopes for a common peaceful future based on universal values, social justice, and respect of human rights. Much has been since achieved, but regrettably, the vision of the founders of the organization is far from being fulfilled. We witness today a large humanitarian crisis, unprecedented movements of displaced people, and an increase of poverty, violence, extremism, and human rights abuses. Nevertheless, the big question for us is not to identify the challenges we face. The people of this world know very well what they face every day. The big question that this great organization was set up to answer is how do we deal with these challenges on the basis of our shared values on the United Nations Charter. Unfortunately, as years go by, we seem to be returning not only to the same problems, but to the same old failed recipes that fostered these problems in the first place. This is why the biggest challenge we face today is an existential one. Whether to continue with the same old recipes of social exclusion, political fragmentation, and economic aggression, or to try to reclaim our future step by step, with confidence, but also with the ability to learn from our mistakes. Allow me to refer to the efforts of my own country, but also with the ability to learn from our mistakes. Allow me to refer to the efforts of my own country in confronting three specific crises in the last few years. As many other countries, Greece was hit hard by the 2008 economic crisis due to the structural weaknesses of its economy and its high debt and budgetary deficits. Yet the neoliberal recipe we and other European countries were called to implement came at devastating social cost and contributed to deepening the economic and fiscal crisis instead of curing it. We lost 25% of our GDP. Our debt-GDP ratio grew to 180%, while unemployment reached 27% and the migration of graduates to European countries accelerated. What we faced was a firm commitment of some to the idea that Greece must exit the Eurozone, or that the institutional and structural reforms that we need have to be combined with austerity, tough austerity measures and welfare and wage cuts. After many months of negotiation, Greece agreed to a new stabilization program that includes reforms in our public administration, pension and tax system, and gives us the opportunity to stabilize our economy by setting the foundation for a necessary reprofiling of our debt. Unfortunately, at the same time, in imposes measures burdening further both society and the economy, these measures should have been avoided. We needed and still need to struggle step by step to claim a growth rather than an austerity agenda, to protect the most vulnerable members of society and distribute tax burdens justly, to link the development of the economy and the restoration of confidence to the need for a restructuring of our debt. How familiar does this sound to others in this assembly? How many times since the 70s have countries in the developed and more recently in the developing world struggled to face exactly these problems that concern not just their weaknesses, but the recipes they are given to deal with them? We have to realize that we need a global financial and economic system oriented to fostering national growth strategies and our post-2015 development agenda. We have to discuss the issue of debt restructuring in all competent fora, including this one, in connection to developing growth and not austerity strategies. Another regional European crisis where Greece is at the forefront concerns recent unprecedented migration flows. Since the beginning of the year, over 300,000 people, mostly from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, have entered the country with the aim of transiting to Western European countries. Greece, like all other European countries, was taken aback by this development. Nevertheless, the people of Greece showed their solidarity in providing food and shelter to the refugees. In cooperation with the European Union and other international organizations, we are doing all we can to manage these flows in an effective and humane way. By improving reception facilities and identification procedures, as well as setting up hotspots to facilitate relocation. Nevertheless, for some, the only way to deal with this challenge is to build walls higher, to repel migrants by force, or to ensure that they remain someone else's responsibility as far away as possible. We do not believe that the future of Europe or the future of our world can be built on ever higher walls or children dying and at our doorsteps. Neither can we forget that many of our ancestors were refugees and migrants. We cannot allow racism and xenophobia to destroy our common principles. In the framework of the UN, we have to build the necessary resettlement mechanism from countries neighboring Syria while also supporting them directly in hosting refugees and dismantling trafficking networks. This resettlement mechanism, together with the existing relocation mechanism in Europe, will give hope to these people, discouraging them from trusting traffickers. Furthermore, we have to increase support for frontline European states such as Greece in their effort to manage these flows. Greece is also at the center of a third security crisis that causes this refugee crisis. We are at the heart of a triangle of destabilization with Ukraine to the north, and the conflicts in Libya and in the Middle East to the southwest and southeast. Located in this unstable environment, Greece has been striving to bolster regional security and supports all efforts promoting peace and stability. Nevertheless, again, we hear some insisting that we should embark on unilateral initiatives without considering the prospects and consequences, or leave the conflicts to be settled by themselves without contributing to stabilization or reconstruction. Yet these are exactly the mistakes that brought us here in the first place. We do not have the luxury to make foreign policy choices without examining in advance what the consequences will be. In Syria, we must act decisively in favor of reconciliation and the political solution that would lay the ground for the Syrian-led democratic transition foreseen in the Geneva Communique. In this regard, we support initiatives aiming at engagement with all relevant international and regional actors. In Libya, we fully support United Nations efforts and we welcome the successful completion of negotiations and political dialogue last week. Furthermore, we believe that the Middle East peace process is of key importance for the region. A new momentum for a solution must be promoted with a view to the creation of a state of Palestine on the basis of the pre-1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital that coexists peacefully with Israel. Concerning Ukraine, we support its territorial integrity independence and sovereignty with its internationally recognized borders. We appreciate the efforts of the Normandy Group and the conciliatory role of the OSCE to avoid a vicious cycle of militarization in the region. And we call on the Minsk Agreement signatories to implement the agreements in full. We are also deeply concerned about the rise of jihadism, which must be dealt with decisively and comprehensively. Beyond the crisis I mentioned, Greece attaches particular importance to engagement with its immediate neighborhood. There also it's important to foster new initiatives rather than remain trapped in the dead ends of the past. I spoke of the need to avoid constructing walls, and truly it is shameful that for the last 41 years, the same number as my age, Cyprus remains divided. Today, more than ever, and in light of the instability in our region, it's important that the momentum is grasped for a mutually acceptable, just, viable, and comprehensive solution to the Cypriot issue, based on the relevant United Nations resolution and on Cyprus' membership on the European Union. To the benefit of all the people of Cyprus, Greek and Turkish Cypriots, as well as all other communities. In this context, I would like to underline Greece's full support to intercommunal talks held under the leadership of President Anastasiades and the head of the Turkish Cypriot community, Mr. Akinci. I firmly believe that any real and lasting solution will have to eventually deal with the international issue of security. The cancellation of the anachronistic treaties of alliance and guarantees, and the withdrawal of all foreign troops, including the troops occupying the northern part of this island. As a regional player keen on promoting security in the area, Greece has been making steady efforts to improve cooperation with Turkey. We have done so through a wide range of initiatives, including the promotion of our dialogue on confidence-building measures, full respect of good neighborly relations, and international law by Turkey, as well as a just and viable solution to the Cypriot issue remain a precondition for full normalization of Greek-Turkish relations. In the Western Balkans, we promote robust bilateral relations and the commitment to the region's European perspective. Greece has stepped up efforts towards the settlement of all differences in the region, among them the name issue of the former Yugoslavia Republic of Macedonia. We have proposed a pragmatic settlement framework aiming at reaching an agreement and agreed a set of confidence-building measures which provide us with an opportunity to further enhance bilateral cooperation and trust. Mr. President, people all around the globe are striving for a better future for them and their children. People in my country are struggling every day with pride and dignity to overcome crisis and regain hope. Even in their most difficult moments, they are assisting those more in need, those fleeing conflict zones. Even in their most difficult moments, they are asserting their democratic right to choose their own fate. This is a daily example of people insisting, even under the most difficult conditions, on their basic humanity and democratic rights. This example should guide us in taking the necessary steps towards a safer, just, and prosperous world for ourselves and the future generations to live in. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.